Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Our producer is Patricia Colburn. The stories we tell about our experience, our history, shape our sense of what's possible. The stories we're told about what happens influence our understanding of the present and of the future. When the police describe the killing in Normandale Park as a confrontation between a homeowner and armed protesters, that's a very different message about what is real than saying a mentally unstable, misogynist, white supremacist charged out of his apartment and opened fire at close range on a group of unarmed women preparing a peaceful demonstration. Similarly, when the origin of the United States is presented as unique among nations, as motivated by pure and exalted ideals, that's a differing message than recognizing the role of slavery in the founding of this country and the continuing need to reckon with that legacy and its consequences. And that's our motif for today, the underlying premises that affect our participation in the world. Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talk about gun violence, the tragedies we've undergone, and the need to counter the assumptions behind the police narratives. I'll look at an extraordinary book by a lifelong white activist whose perspective underwent significant change when he learned more about Black history and experience. Bill Resnick talks again with M.V. Ramana about conventional prejudices about our use of energy, about the questions that the corporate economy suppresses, about the social and political premises hidden in what's presented as neutral technology. Even our music fits our motif in a very subtle way. We'll hear Nina Simone turn a European classic into a lament and fantasy from the standpoint of Black women. In turning to our discussion of gun violence, I'm reminded of the important role radio plays to inform us and join us together as a community. Jan and Mike will talk about the contribution of social media in challenging the police account. But it's not on social media, but on KBOO that we get their thoughtful analysis. 4/5 of the funds that keep KBOO on the air come from listener donations. If you're able, please kick something in. The easiest way is to go to the website, kboo.fm, and find the Give button. We'll mention other ways of contributing in the course of today's program. Now, let's hear Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker with their left and the law analysis of the recent gun violence in Portland and beyond. Jan?
Crime covers a lot of ground, as do rates of various categories of crime. Well, Mike, today let's talk about gun violence and homicide rates that have risen in recent years, including here in Portland, starting with the three scenes of fatal shootings in Portland over the weekend of February 19th and 20th, and particularly the mass shooting at a racial justice protest event in Northeast Portland. Before we turn to the coverage of this tragedy through the media and police reports, what happened that, and why were the protesters gathered? I think a part of the story that often gets lost in the incident and the conflicting accounts of the shootings themselves.
Well, Jen, the reason why people were gathered was because of the murder of Amir Locke in Minneapolis. And it was an atrocious event because it was a systemic murder. It wasn't like a rogue devil cop. It was a murder executed and orchestrated by the entire Minneapolis criminal justice system, who gave a no-knock search warrant to the cops on the flimsiest of reasons. So the cops are entering the house of Amir Locke at 7 a.m., They obtained a key of their own. So they're unlocking his house and they come in and they're shouting. So Locke is asleep on the couch. he has a weapon of his own because of the proliferation of guns, I imagine. But anyway, he is duly licensed and was there to protect himself, but he didn't have a chance. There were three or four cops immediately around him, and as soon as he reaches and touches his gun, they fire many shots and kill him. So people were gathered in the park to protest this murder of a young Black man, which was, as I said, the outcome of a system, not of a particularly deranged individual.
The Minneapolis police have not been particularly chastened by the murder of George Floyd and the uprisings around the country and the world, basically, in response to that. And so the ongoing demonstrations and remembrance of Black people being killed by the police was part of what happened here in Northeast Portland. Let's exactly. talk about the media coverage of the most media intensive of the shootings that weekend, because of course it did focus on police violence and resistance to police violence, and unfolded in a way that began with the police having their own press conference on Sunday morning, the police chief. What was striking to you about the media coverage of the shootings as they unfolded?
Well, at first, how little of it there was. I mean, it was agonizingly slow for the details to be revealed. The police press conference gave almost no details and was profoundly misleading. What we now know happened is that a gunman, Benjamin Smith, killed a 60-year-old woman who wounded three other women and another man who were a volunteer security guard for the protest who were directing traffic, not even close to the actual demonstration itself. He started shooting them and was only stopped by a security guard who's heard what was happened, hurried over and shot the gunman Smith in his hip.
A security guard with the demonstration itself.
Yes. So the next morning, we found out almost none of this. Instead, we had a statement that from the cops attributing the violence to the confrontation between an armed homeowner and armed protesters.
That was the focus of considerable outrage on social media. What's implicit in using the term homeowner in describing the gunman?
Well, your home is your castle. It's a fundamental principle of American law. Anybody who's fighting to defend themselves in their own home, you're allowed to shoot anybody who might even be threatening to come into your house. It's a whole other concept than somebody who's out on the street roaming around carrying a weapon. It's a fundamental distortion of the facts.
As was the framing of the violence as a confrontation between armed protesters and an armed homeowner.
That's right. The traffic guards were strikingly nonviolent. They always had been. The woman who died had been made herself available to do just that sort of work at demonstrations. It was completely nonviolent. They were directing traffic.
You know, it struck me that if this had been a mass shooting at a school or a mall, that the security person licensed to carry an arm who shot and disabled the gunman would have been declared a hero. But in this case, there was just a question of whether charges would be filed, and no charges were filed because it was clearly a defensive act. Why wasn't this security person declared a hero?
Well, I think he was a hero. I think it's a paradox in that it's very clear that the only kind of crime that has really been increasing over the last 2 years is gun violence. Robberies, rapes, property crimes, they've all either remained level or mostly gone down. But easy access to guns has meant that disputes of all sorts, which are part of living in a human society, now get resolved with weapons. And so the number of people shot has gone up, even though the total remains about a third, about a third of what it was in the 90s. But still, directionality is important. And even though the overall totals are far less than they were a couple decades ago, they are getting worse. They are increasing.
Well, what lessons might we draw from this tragedy? There's both the outrage over the police and the mayor reporting and framing of it. But I think what was also important was organized activists challenging those accounts and pushing the Oregonian to properly cover the shootings and pushing back on the police narrative. So that seems to be one of the important lessons.
You know, social media has been deservedly getting a bad rap lately. The fact that Facebook thrives on confrontation and aggression and creates it in order to increase engagement. There's all kinds of things damning social media that have emerged. But here we should be grateful because it was the various tweets and communications on social media that made the truth come out. The Oregonian found these people as a result of social media. Finally, a couple of days later, had a good story about what happened. One point I'd like to make is, it doesn't seem to be an immediate link, but actually it is. And that is the $73 million settlement that was made just 5 days ago when gun manufacturers, or rather their insurance companies, for the Sandy Hook incident, had to pay out $73 million. And this is, and the reason they were forced to do it was because they found, the plaintiffs found, an ingenious way around the federal law that insulates gun manufacturers from any damages for anything anybody ever does with their weapons. What these clever plaintiffs found was a Connecticut law, state law, about consumer advertising. And they, through discovery, found that Remington was issuing ads about AR-15s, which are semi-automatic weapons that can be converted to automatic weapons. Exactly the weapon that was used by the young man who killed all those kids in Connecticut. And what they came up with was an ad, a picture of a AR-15 in some great detail. And the caption is, "Consider your man card reissued, Bushmaster."
Well, I think this is very relevant to the situation of Benjamin Smith, who has been universally declared a right winger, white supremacist, was clearly, you know, misogynist, had become, according to his roommate, more and more angry, obsessed with guns, angry about houseless people, the Black Lives Matter movement and protests. And there was something fueling his fire as an apparently fairly isolated, wasn't associated with organized far right groups, but there was something fueling his fire and directing his anger and his increasing preoccupation with weapons.
And discovery of Remington's internal documents show that he is precisely the kind of person they're as aimed at. The quote, so-called couch commandos, people who live in a fantasy world of their own, who are not engaged in any great detail with either their work or with any other social movement or with their family.
By the way, are more apt to be younger white men.
Yep, exactly. So there are targeted ads aimed at exactly the category of person he is, which are effective. Of course, guns have proliferated so much that now the people buying them are the secondary level of people who aren't so fond of guns, who don't believe that their masculinity hinges on buying a gun, but who are afraid of all the people around who have guns.
So, yeah, even including at protest events.
Exactly.
So getting back to the reason for the demonstration that you began with and the protesters gathering to in remembrance of Emir Locke and protesting ongoing police killings. How should those of us who call for decarceration, abolishing of policing, how do we assess the victories through the courts in prosecuting white supremacists and police who killed Black people? I know Mike Schmidt here, and in this case, the DA is putting forth relatively serious, not surprisingly, charges against Benjamin Smith. But how do you think about the call for more serious, aggressive prosecution of police and racists versus our larger call for the abolition of policing and alternative means of addressing problems outside the criminal justice system?
Well, I think what needs to happen is an equal enforcement. That is, Schmidt's charges are totally appropriate. The disposition of the defendants who were found guilty is another question. But I think in the South, the great thing, and the irony to me is the South, source of segregationists, and is moving in the right direction in that they're now trying and convicting people for the same crimes that they would have certainly charged Black people with. So there's they're moving toward equivalence. Whereas
which is a form of progress.
It's very much a form of progress. In fact, it's the fundamental form of progress, I think. Equal treatment under the laws. That's precisely what Black people have never had in any systematic way. And it's something we should always move toward. Now, what we're going to do with people after we convict them is a completely separate question in my mind. But there needs to be absolute equal enforcement of the laws. The most discouraging thing to me about the killing of Emir Locke is that the liberal mayor, Jacob Frey, had promised before not to do no-knock warrants. And there's all kinds of efforts to train, retrain, and re-retrain the police. There are vows made, but they just all fade away. And this whole no-knock warrant and the flimsy reasons given for it could have happened 5 years ago. So it means that reform is much more than just a statement or a press release mollifying people who are pressing you. It's a difficult thing. It should be a sustained thing. And it definitely needs to happen in Minneapolis.
So in closing, it's important to honor racial justice activist June Knightley, a beloved member of the community who had been part of protests for years, and the LGBTQ community, and also the reason for their meeting that night, a demonstration that was called short as June Knightley gave her life unwillingly to the, in remembrance of Emir Locke, the Black man who was killed by Minneapolis police. So this struggle continues. Thanks, Mike. On a upcoming show, we'll also talk about the gains on the front of progressive prosecutors around the country.
There are lots of them, and they are now organized.
More to discuss in the future in the Left and the Law.
Thank you, Jan and Mike. Patricia, we're in the middle of KBOO's fundraising drive.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and we are now in our All Thrills, No Frills winter drive. As part of the drive, KBOO is bringing you a month of special musical and public affairs programming, including a dance party marathon, a series on Black history, and a special on International Women's Day. To see what's on the schedule, go to kboo.fm. It's all right there on our homepage. And while you're there, you can click on the big donate button and become a part of the KBOO community. You can also text KBOO to 44321 or send a check by snail mail to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. We need your support to stay on the air. And a big thanks to all of you who have given so generously in the past.
We'll hear Patricia again, including in the next part of the program, the piece we call Another World is Possible. Let's begin this episode of Another World is Possible with a story. Stop me if you've heard this one. A man went to a highly recommended tailor to be fitted for a suit for his daughter's wedding. Came the day of the celebration, and he went to pick up his new suit. It didn't fit at all, and there was no time for alterations. "Don't worry," the tailor told him. "If you just raise your left shoulder, the jacket will look fine." But doing that pushed his right sleeve over his hand. Once again, the tailor assured him, "Just keep your right arm twisted slightly and raised in front of your chest, and the suit will fit perfectly." The same with the pants. If he kept his stomach pushed way forward, walked with one foot out to the side, and took longer steps with it, and shorter steps with the other foot, the pants, too, would fit. That story, which in some versions has an even funnier punchline, is the takeoff point for Robert Paul Wolff's critique of the conventional way in which U.S. history has been widely understood, written about, taught, and most importantly, distorted, especially about race. The self-serving conventional master narrative is in a state of constant apologetic adjustments when what's needed is a new fitting, a new tailoring from start to finish, from 1492 and 1619 to the present. As Wolff says,
"Stories have a power to shape our experience, to impose interpretations on what we think we know, both true stories and fictional ones. The story of America organizes our collective social memory, highlighting turning points, bringing some facts into sharp focus, concealing others. If our national story is told wrongly, we shall forget our real past, and then, because stories have this power, we shall misunderstand our present and lose the ability to shape our future. Freud says somewhere that if there is any one subject that it is not permitted to discuss in an analysis, sooner or later the entire analysis comes to be about that one subject. Race is the dirty little secret of the American story, not greed, not sex, not power. Until the American story is rewritten with the fact of slavery and its aftermath given its true place, none of us in the white community will be able to understand the story of America aright."
I'm talking about the extraordinary experience Wolff recounts in his book, Autobiography of an Ex-White Man, Learning a New Master Narrative for America. While my focus could easily be on the history Wolff learned, it's how he learned it that mainly interests me. Wolff was already an accomplished professor nearing the end of his career, a noted anarchist theoretician, a street activist and a teacher of Marxism, who then was invited to switch academic departments from philosophy to Afro-American studies. He became the lone white faculty member in a department of distinguished black scholars and artists. He had thought he already knew what there was to know about capitalist exploitation, about imperialism. The book is his account of his transformation that resulted from being pushed to engage with a black perspective. The process by which people's ideas change, how their premises about what's possible can be transformed, is a fundamental issue as we envision social change. It's an issue we come back to repeatedly and address from many angles here at Another World is Possible. Political movements have foundered because they've misunderstood it, thinking, for instance, that people can be won over simply by hectoring them or giving them the right reading material, or the opposite, by pushing a confrontational militancy without also stepping back to take stock and reevaluate. Movements, labor unions, even revolutionary societies get stuck on particular tactics that may have worked in the past. Staying open, continuing to learn, is unfortunately rare and something we and our movements all need to aspire to. And that's the merit of Wolf's book. Here's what he says about his trajectory.
Before I began my journey, I thought of myself as a sensitive, knowledgeable, politically committed advocate of racial justice. But as I took the first steps along the way, I began to realize that I understood little or nothing at all about that color line called by W.E.B. Du Bois, the problem of the 20th century. So, rather like the conventional Christian who seeks to become truly a Christian, my task was to undergo a difficult process of re-education and self-examination in order to end up where I thought I had begun, as a committed advocate of racial justice. Perhaps I can take some comfort from Socrates' teaching that the first step of the journey toward wisdom is the acknowledgement that one is ignorant. I had no inkling that before too many years had gone by, my whole way of seeing the world would change.
We've been transformed by Black Lives Matter, a movement that came after Wolf wrote. Even lifelong white radicals are more attuned to issues of race and racial justice. I certainly am. While the specifics of what Wolf learned about race in U.S. history are less important for our purposes than the fact that he learned them, the fact that an old dog can learn new tricks, I still want to highlight examples of his new understanding. He learned that protecting the institution of slavery was fundamental in the colony's decision to declare independence from England, and that the United States was founded on bondage of white workers as well as blacks. That racism was not at the roots of slavery, but developed more as a justification for economic exploitation. That rape of slave women was not only an expression of power, but also an intentional economic act, as the price of new slaves soared when the Atlantic slave trade was cut off. That the decisive act in the North's Civil War victory was the decision by Southern black slaves to stop producing for their masters and for the Confederacy, what W.E.B. Du Bois called a general strike. That after the Civil War, former slaves who had been competent in a whole range of skilled labor were intentionally de-skilled, no longer employed as mechanics, field supervisors, boat builders, etc., to further the narrative of black incapability and dependency. That terrorism against former slaves was facilitated by the fact that they were no longer someone's property, that there was no longer a disincentive to cripple or kill. I have some reservations about Wolf's book, particularly his surprising lack of class differentiation among whites when it comes to racism on the job. White workers have indeed been racist, but it's necessary to separate their motives and their sense of vulnerability from the motives of employers who have a stake in keeping workers divided. This is a fine book to read for a quick reconceptualization of U.S. history. It's a wonderful book to read about the process of rethinking what we thought we knew. Even as we have fully developed critiques of the social economic system that dominates our lives, stay open to new insights. That's part of how we'll get to that another world we know is possible. I've been discussing Robert Paul Wolf's autobiography of an ex-white man. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour, leaving the last word to the author.
North America is now in its fifth century of racial oppression and injustice. Only concerted, unrelenting action for racial justice will change half a millennium of injustice. I am mindful of the young Karl Marx's call to arms in his famous 11th thesis on Feuerbach. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. I think Marx would agree that we can succeed in changing the world only if we understand it. It is my hope that this slender volume will make a contribution to that understanding.
It was Marx, of course, who gave us the Old Mole name for this program. And it was Bill Resnick, rumor has it, who was the recipient of Marx's gift. In a moment, Bill continues the conversation he began last week with M.V. Ramana on different possible approaches to generating energy as we aim to reconstruct the world. But first, Patricia again, with a more modest goal, keeping KABU on the air.
KABU's winter membership drive is now in progress. We're asking you, our loyal listeners, to support volunteer-powered, non-commercial radio in Portland. KABU is your source for news and analysis that goes beyond what you hear on commercial radio to get at the roots of what ails us, and also to highlight the work of activists, especially locally, to build a more just and equitable society. Shows like More Talk Radio, Locus Focus, Counterspin, Flashpoints, and the Old Mole Variety Hour keep you informed about the issues and happenings that matter most to you. Please help keep community radio alive in Portland by donating to KBOO today. You can go to kboo.fm/give to donate. You can also text KBOO to 44321 or send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. And thanks to everyone who has supported KABU over the years.
And now, Bill Resnick with M.V. Ramana.
Ramana, welcome to KABU again.
Thank you, Bill.
Ramana is a distinguished physicist. Over the years, came to recognize that climate change joins nuclear weapons and accidents like Fukushima as looming threats to human life. He's known internationally for his work on how to replace both nuclear and fossil fuel energy, and in the process, restore planetary ecosystems, that is, replace them with clean sun and wind energy. He's taught, researched, written, and agitated at the Nuclear Futures Laboratory and the Program on Science and Global Security, both at Princeton U. He's now at the University of British Columbia School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. He and several colleagues recently wrote the article, How Electric Utilities Thwart Climate Action, Politics and Power. That's in this month's edition of the Journal Against the Current. The article discusses one of several ways that the investor-owned utilities and their financiers and investors are trying to remain in control and make huge profits by stifling the growth of public community electricity providers who are far more quickly, cheaply, and reliable building systems such that their cities and counties become 100% carbon. There are many of them now in the United States. Earlier this year, the Mole interviewed Ramana on those private investor-owned utilities on their false claims about the alleged safety of the newest small designs for nuclear power plants that they are planning to construct across the country and planet. Last week, we discussed another of their dangerous plans, that is to use natural gas as a bridge fuel before they begin building out their nuclear power stations and sun and wind farms. They want to get the most out of their coal and primitive natural gas plants before they change. This, of course, ignores scientific warnings that we must go to clean sun and wind energy in the next 10 years, which natural gas is surely not clean energy if we hope to survive. Today, we will switch gears, go positive, discuss how the U.S. and the nations of the world
and reject the plans and expensive technologies of the private investor-owned utilities like PG&E and Pacific Power. Instead, we have to immediately build out sun and wind-based generations that can respond to the threat of climate change in a very short amount of time that the climate scientists believe is necessary. So, Romana, tell us about those strategies.
Yeah, I think we have to think about this in two ways. One is there are, as you mentioned, a very large suite of technologies that are ready to deploy, that are relatively cheap, and which can be brought online at very short order, within a decade or two. These are the well-known solar and wind technologies, but also a whole range of technologies that can change the demand side, the demand that is for electricity that's being created, and how it can be shaped in multiple ways, either by making appliances that one uses more efficient, by changing when we use some of these things so that it matches better with when the energy flows into the system come in. One of the complaints that you hear from the industry and by mainstream media, including people like Bill Gates and so on, is that the sun and wind energy are not reliable. Cliche they use is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And of course that is true, but it doesn't rain all the time. That hasn't stopped us from being able to get water when we turn the tap on. Likewise, there are ways by which one can manage an electricity grid that can deal with the variability of solar and wind power and manage the grid efficiently so that you can still get your electricity reliably. Okay? That said, there's also a more basic question that we have to ask, which is going back to the discussion we had earlier about how the elite would like us to try to keep the current system as it is without changing anything fundamental, and yet deal with climate change, and I explained why that is an impossible quest. So the question we have to ask ourselves, at least those people who would like to see ourselves as progressives or those who are sort of questioning the system, the question we have to ask ourselves is, what aspects of the system do we have to maintain, and what do we not have to maintain? And what should we actually let go? And in that sense, I would say the mainstream discussion completely neglects the question of what uses we think are legitimate and what are not. So if you think about a different area, which is transportation, where, again, we would have to reduce our emissions drastically, and we have to ask, how can we do it? One option that is presented to us is to say, move to electric cars from internal combustion vehicles. This is what the dream that Elon Musk and Tesla sell us. And that's fine as it is, but it never brings up the question, two questions which never come up. One is, is a car the most efficient way for people to go from one place to the other? How about public transportation? How do we make it more accessible, more affordable, and more easy for people to use? And what kinds of investments need to go in there? That question almost never comes up. And the second question, of course, is also what kind of transport patterns are being engendered upon us by the current system of where houses are, where jobs are, what kinds of transportation is being required, how the concentration of groceries and so on in large shops as opposed to neighborhood shops. All these multiple things contribute to the demand for energy in this world, and we have to be thinking about all of those things. Now, those things take time, but the focus on technology means that all of those social and political questions completely get swept aside. And I think it's important for people who see themselves as progressives to be asking those questions, to be probing those directions of changes.
Hi, folks. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Romana, a physicist, a scholar, an activist who, like the great majority of climate scientists, challenged the corporate elite's plans for dealing with the threat of climate change. One element of the corporate plan is for using nuclear power and natural gas to meet the challenge of climate change, Well, slowly, slowly building out sun and wind installations in remote places, and also building out huge, high-security, continent-spanning, high-voltage grids to deliver the power to consumers in most living cities. Vermont emphasizes the necessity of very swiftly building out sun and wind generation and electric power. He also challenges the corporate elite's plan to use bridge fuels and slowly build out sun and wind, and also challenges the corporate plan to keep near everything about U.S. society, but its energy supply unchanged. That's, for example, maintaining cars as dominant in human transport and building more highways instead of public transit. We now continue the interview examining the corporate attack and the potentials for community energy networks to stop global roasting. Another claim by the investor-owned utilities and all the others who, in fact, are opposed to the sun and wind technologies that could put them out of business, actually, and those technologies that, if they were implemented by people who actually are interested in something other than profit. Another one of their claims is that, look, we want sun and wind as much as anybody else, but we want to do it efficiently by putting plants in just the right areas with the maximum steady winds and the maximum steady sun. And then we need a big grid to transport all that energy, a big grid crossing rivers and mountains and forests and setting those forests afire. Of course, they don't talk about that, or the damage that would be done by setting up a whole new interstate transportation system of electricity crisscrossing everywhere through farmland as well, which would take a huge amount of time to build out, but they don't talk about that either. How do you reply to the people who say, look, the sun shines everywhere, the wind blows everywhere, that's at different speeds, but we in fact, but the wind turbines and solar panels will in fact create a lot of energy in places where it isn't sunny and windy all the time, like in Germany and California, in fact, where there's a lot of sun, or in fact in Maine, where studies have been done. Maine is relatively cloudy in the United States, and yet it has a very large amount of wind and sun. What do you make of that we can locally produce sufficient amounts of energy to power a very modern and decent society?
Yes, there's definitely a lot of studies that show that, you know, one can produce a lot of power locally. There are, I think, two separate problems there. One problem is that if you're talking about cities, for example, I live in Vancouver and I live in a rented apartment here, and so my apartment block has about 100 apartments, and the rooftop space we have is not going to be adequate for that. And you know, in more suburban or rural settings, this is not going to be a problem. But if you want to minimize the amount of transportation, it is good to have certain concentrated settlements as well. So there is a trade-off between how we reduce our demands for energy for transportation with the amount of energy that we can produce locally. So that's one issue. The second issue is that, as you mentioned, if homeowners, those of the homeowners who can put up solar panels on their roofs and so on, start doing that, then it starts affecting the profit model that utility companies are built on, right? They are built on selling you electricity. And if you're going to be generating most of your electricity yourself, then that's going to affect their profitability. And so there's a lot of pushback. And there is pushback started maybe about a decade ago. And the so-called Edison Institute, which is an institution that tries to represent the interests of electric utilities, it put up a report saying basically we seem to be going into a debt spiral. So what they were envisioning is more and more households start putting up solar panels. They reduce their demand for grid electricity, but the grid still has to be there because there are going to be some people who don't have access to solar power on their rooftops. And also the households that have solar power might be using the grid during those times when there is no sun. And so the grid has to exist, but it is going to exist on a smaller and smaller rate base. Therefore, they are going to become more unprofitable. They'll have to cut down their costs, which then means that the grid will become more unreliable, and so on and so forth. And this was the debt spiral, a vicious loop that the utility companies were seeing. And they started pushing back by saying, we will not support policy measures like net metering, which means that you actually can get paid for the electricity that you export to the grid. If you're not using the electricity then that your solar panel is producing, then you can actually give it to the grid and get credits for that. And that is a program called net metering, which these electric utility companies didn't like. And so there's a lot of battles in multiple states that have been going on since then about what the rate for the net metering should be, whether it should be allowed at all, et cetera, et cetera. So there are these two levels at which I think this is going to be a problem for the current system. But you're absolutely correct. In principle, the more energy we can generate locally, the better it is. It is true that, you know, the larger utility scale plant is typically going to cost less than a rooftop solar field simply because of the economies of scale that are there. You know, for somebody to be able to put up something on their rooftop means that a professional will have to come, you know, install it on the rooftop. It takes like a day or something of that sort, whereas in a day, they can probably install 100 of these panels on a big field. But the converse of it is that if you're trying to do things on your rooftop locally in small scale, then you're going to be generating far more jobs for the same amount of electricity that you're producing. And that's a good thing because it feeds back into the local economy. So there are going to be advantages for doing it locally, which are benefiting local people as opposed to distant corporations.
By locally, we don't mean, though, just around the corner or even a mile away. Locally can be 20 or 30 or 40 miles away, and still we save billions, trillions of dollars on having these much smaller, lower voltage, much more easy to repair, much more reliable local grids than scaling mountains and going over rivers and ruining farmlands that the utilities seem to think is necessary to maintain control of the system.
It all depends on how we shape the demand for energy.
Right. There'll be many large plants, but they'll be strategically located as near as possible.
Yeah, the aim would be to optimize the system so that you require less of these kind of mega grids, transmission corridors being cut across different states. And yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it was really good talking to you, Ramana. I hope we can talk again about how this energy revolution is now beginning to proceed. Hey, thanks a lot, Ramana.
Thank you, Bill. Lovely talking to you. Okay, take care.
Good talking to you. Thank you. You just heard an interview with Ramana, a distinguished physicist, and several international scientific groups studying and suggesting alternative courses. That is alternative to now dominant corporate plans. Alternative distraction and threats of nuclear reactors and climate change through community energy. You can find Ramana's previous KABU interviews by going to the KABU website, finding the search box on the homepage upper right, and typing in Ramana, R-A-M-A-N-A.
Thank you, Bill and Ramana. Bill will return next week with analysis of what's behind the Russian invasion of the Ukraine and the likely consequences. Finally, on today's program, I only recently discovered a spectacular musical performance I'd like to share with you. It's Nina Simone singing Pirate Jenny. You may know Pirate Jenny from the Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht Three Penny Opera, the one that also has Mac the Knife. In the original, Jenny is a prostitute who is bribed to turn Mac in to the police. Here's just a bit of Marianne Faithfull's excellent version, very close to the German original. Thanks to old mole Denise Morris for suggesting it.
You lot see me dunk the glasses, wash the floors, make the beds. I'm the best of servants. You can kindly throw me pennies and I'll thank you very much. You see me ragged and tattered in this dirty shit hotel. You don't know in hell who's talking. You still don't know in hell who's talking. Still one fine day there will be roars from the harbour, and you'll ask what is all that screeching for. And you'll see me smiling as I dunk the glasses, and you'll say, what's she got to smile at for? And the ship, eight sails shining, 55 cannons wide, sir, waits there at the quay.
Now let's listen to the same part from Nina Simone. Notice how she changes the wording, for instance, from a ship eight sails shining to a ship a black freighter, and from 50 cannons to a black flag.
While I'm scrubbing these floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking. Maybe once you tip me and it makes you feel swell in this crummy southern town, in this crummy old hotel, but you'll never guess to who you're talking. No, you could never guess to who you're talking. Then one night there's a scream in the night, and you wonder who could that have been. And you see me kind of grinning while I'm scrubbing, and you say, what's she got to grin? I'll tell you, there's a ship, the Black Freighter, with a skull on its masthead, will be coming in.
Did you notice, too, how she slows it down? To my ear, Nina Simone has converted this European classic into a statement about the disrespect for the work and the personhood of black women, and finally into a fantasy of black women's revenge. This is from a live performance at Carnegie Hall. We'll have time only for some of it, but you can easily find it in its entirety, including its stunning ending. Here's Nina Simone with more of Pirate Jenny.
You gentlemen can say, hey gal, finish them floors, get upstairs, what's wrong with you, earn your keep here. And you toss me your tips and look out to the ships, but I'm counting your heads as I'm making the beds, cause there's nobody gonna sleep here tonight. Nobody's gonna sleep here, honey. Nobody. Nobody. Then one night, there's a scream in the night, and you say, who's that kicking up a row? And you see me kind of staring out the window, and you say, what's she got to stare at now? I'll tell you, there's a ship, the Black Freighter, turns around in the harbor, shooting guns from her bow. Now, you gentlemen can wipe off that smile off your face, cause every building in town is a flat one. This whole frickin' place will be down to the ground. Only this cheap hotel standing up safe and sound. And you yell, why do they spare that one? Yes, that's what you say. Why do they spare that one? All the night through, through the noise, reason to do. You wonder who is that person that lives up there. And you see me stepping out in the morning, looking nice with a ribbon in my hair. And the ship, the black freighter, runs a flag up its masthead and a cheer rings the air.
And that's our program for today. Thanks to Old Moles, Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, Denise Morris, Patricia Kohlberg, and to guest M.V. Ramana. This is Norm Diamond. We'll go out with a final word from Patricia. Come back to us next and every Monday morning. Meanwhile, and especially now, stay safe and do stay active. Patricia?
Before we conclude this morning, I want to remind you that you are listening to volunteer-powered and listener-supported radio, and that we depend on listeners like you for ongoing support. Tune in to the special programs coming up as part of our All Thrills, No Frills campaign, including an International Women's Day special, an R&B hip-hop marathon, and a series on Black history and the future. The schedule of our special programming is available at kboo.fm. Our thanks to everyone who has donated to keep community radio alive in Portland. If you can, please become a member of the KBOO community. Send us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Click on our donate button on our homepage at kboo.fm. Or simply text KBOO to 44321.